From Sacramento, the Bishop's Radio Hour with Bob Dunning. Focusing on today's issues in the context of gospel values. Now, here's Bob Dunning on Relevant Radio.
That's me. Welcome to you on this beautiful day the Lord has made. Appreciate you all being with us on the Bishop's Hour. And we are just thrilled to have Bishop Jaime Soto sitting across the table from us. Bishop, good day.
Good day, Bob. It's good to see you, and I hope the family's doing well.
Family's doing very, very well during Lent, surviving it. Can we stop praying for rain?
No. In my prayers for rain, I do say, please protect the vulnerable.
Yes.
Please protect the vulnerable. Yeah. And to that point, Bob, I guess it would be a question like that would be better directed to farmers.
You know? It would. Yes, St. Isidore.
Yeah. And I've already started the confirmation circuit and going around the different parishes, which is nice. But I've been to. I went to Colusa, and I remember it was a damp day. But I was driving out there, the road takes me out to through the orchards, and they just were all in flower. In flower, yeah. And it was quite beautiful. But I know that there's some anxiety about
rain when the blossoms hit.
That's right. So
that's when the nuts set.
Yeah, well, yeah. I have no idea, but I mean, what the whole sequence is, but I know that there's concern about that. So, farming requires a great deal of trust.
Yes, it does, doesn't it?
And you have to really. Yeah. Trust that that God and nature are going to cooperate.
indeed. So I have to say thank you on behalf of our Irish Catholic family for the dispensation on St. Patrick's Day.
Well, you know, I have it's been pleasant the number of comments that I've received from people about that, and so one that people are they actually pay attention to what what the bishop says, this was the feast day of St. Patrick's, and even though it's Friday, we're going to be able to, enjoy ourselves.
There was a delight. There was a joy in it.
Yeah.
But it reminded us very much of our faith.
It was
beautiful. I remember, I think it was Archbishop Supich in Chicago, who said he wasn't going to issue the blanket dispensation, but he said, if you find yourself in an event where beef is being served, it's okay.
There you go.
Yeah. It had to be corned beef, though, right? I mean, it wasn't a dispensation for anything.
Well, you know, I didn't specifically put that in there, but maybe in the future I'll keep that in mind.
It's one of the joys of Lent. And you know, the Irish weren't stupid. They put St. Patrick's Day right in the middle of Lent. It's always in Lent.
Yeah.
It can't be. Not always on Friday, but always in Lent.
But, I happened to be, actually, when you mentioned that, it was St. Patrick's Day, and that day I visited Christian Brothers High School, had a wonderful visit with the school, but I also offered Mass at the campus. This is small, in the small chapel they have there, with some of the a mixture of students and faculty. But as part of the homily, I mentioned talking about the astuteness of the Irish, that a very good book about St. Patrick and Irish Catholicism that is called How the Irish Saved Civilization.
Oh, right.
Yeah. And that's, I don't know, must be, it could be maybe 20 years old now or something. I think the author is Thomas Cahill.
Right, right.
And it is a kind of tongue-in-cheek book. I mean, but the very title gives that away. But it's also very well-researched and easy to read about St. Patrick and Irish monasticism and how that institution how Catholicism in Ireland and that institution did protect and bolster the preservation of some of the great classics of Western civilization.
Yeah,
with the monks there and the chilly climates of Ireland, transcribing all these great works.
Right. Yeah. It's amazing how many great authors have come out of. Catholic offers have come out of
Ireland,
as well for the small population of the country.
You know, talking about that, I know we were in preparation for this. We were talking about different topics, but maybe this is a good time to also mention Bishop David O'Connell. Bishop David O'Connell was the auxiliary bishop in Los Angeles. A native of Ireland. And now right now I'm sure he has told me, he told me on a number of occasions where in Ireland.
I think it was Cork.
Oh, okay. And, but
County Cork. Yeah.
That was such a blow to the church, particularly the Archdiocese of Los Angeles, and then to the, Bishop David was just a wonderful brother bishop, and we knew each other, and perhaps even more, we knew of each other. I was in the Diocese of Orange, and he was in the Archdiocese of Los Angeles. We're two very different people. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't even begin to compare myself to him. But we were involved in similar kinds of ministry that we happened to like working in more kind of inner city parish situations. And I was working in Santa Ana, which had its challenges.
Sure.
And then David O'Connell was working in Los Angeles. I can't recall some of his assignments, but that he worked with the Hispanic community, but he also worked a lot with the African American community there in Los Angeles, and he was one of their advocates in terms of ministry to the African American community, and in fact, actually, I remember, and David had a way of doing that. Bishop David had a way of doing that was that he could. Challenge, obviously the Archdiocese, in fact, many dioceses in California, were focused on the growing, burgeoning Latino community and how to manage, how to shepherd that growing community. And Bishop David was one of those that obviously was engaged in that, but he was also constantly challenging the church not to forget its ministry to the African Americans, and he was regularly raised the concern that a lot of attention was being given to the Hispanic community to the detriment of the ministry to the African American communities and in many of the almost same communities. And he had a way, his Irish way of cutting an issue that both kind of affirmed and then also challenged. And he had a critical pastoral eye on issues, and he also was a very outspoken, again, particularly again in those communities you know, immigrant and working class communities,
right.
Strong advocate of pro-life and one because that's what the church teaches, but two because he also saw what the abortion industry did to these communities
in those communities
in those
specifically,
communities.
Yeah.
And so he was a very strong advocate in that and. So I think I had a great deal of admiration for him, and so I was delighted when he was, made a bishop, mm-hmm. By Archbishop Gomez.
So you were bishops at the same time when you were in Orange, or were you already?
I was already a bishop, and then, in fact, I'm trying to remember now. I may have already been in Sacramento, uh-huh.
When he became
an auxiliary. Do you happen to know what year it was? But I'm pretty sure of that. I don't want to get sidetracked.
Yeah, he became an auxiliary in 2015.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
So over here.
Yeah, of course. And now I recall because I was also, because of his work, and he again was. Was very active in the community. So, and I, at the time that he was named the bishop, and I was the chair of the Catholic Campaign for Human Development mm-hmm. at the national level. And so when he became a bishop, I don't think the oil was dry on his head. And I was, and I recruited him to be on the committee
right.
with me. And so, and he wound up actually, he eventually became the chair mm-hmm. of the Catholic Campaign for Human Development. And I was serving as the chair, unfortunately, when he was killed in Los Angeles.
Wow. And apparently he was very big on restorative justice as well.
Oh, yes, yeah. That's right, yeah. That's a whole other story, but there was a group of us bishops of California. We went to San Quentin recently. That was
right.
about 2 weeks ago.
Right.
And it was a very good visit, saddened by the fact that, Bishop David was going to be one of our companions on that visit, I'm sure he was with us
yes.
in spirit, but
it was just several weeks after he was killed.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Yeah, maybe not even a month after he was killed. So, yeah, it was. But yes, he was a strong advocate of that, had a wonderful sense of humor, mm-hmm. People of God don't always get to appreciate this aspect of our life together as the collegial nature of a bishop's ministry, and so I mean, but we don't get together often, but we do get together, mm-hmm. And I'll say about California that, we listen to each other mm-hmm. and that people probably, kind of wonder what our conversations may be like. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I can say that they, our conversations as bishops together in California are always very fraternal, very respectful, mm-hmm. Very candid and we all learn. I think we all learn something out of that. All of us feel the push and pull of the adversarial nature of too much public discourse today.
Right.
But in those contexts, it's almost it's kind of an anecdote to that, because we really do listen to each other, and there's a commitment to look for the truth together, but also to how do we serve not only the truth of the gospel but also the communion of the church, mm-hmm. and David Bishop David had a particular way about that, you know, that he, again, you know, his own Irish way of how he would cut an issue. And some of us can get a little, you know, theological and caught up with certain, you know, principles. And David was, I mean, it wasn't like he was against principles, but he also had a way of saying, okay, now here's how that looks on the street. And
uh-huh.
here's,
mm-hmm.
and here's you know, here's what we, you know, yeah. here's what people need to hear. Yeah. And he had a way of keeping us grounded on, you know, on certain issues, and it was a gift to us.
Yeah.
It was a gift, so I know I speak for my brother bishops in California that his untimely passing it does leave a hole, mm-hmm. in our Episcopal College in California. And we will miss him, and we, you know, share the grief and the sorrow of his family and his many friends and all those who knew him so well in the Archdiocese of Los Angeles.
It's beautifully said. You know, there's the testimonials you read, not just from important people, so to speak, but from just people on the street.
Oh yeah,
just
yeah.
the love they had for this man.
Yeah. He had an impact. He had an impact in that. And I remember the eulogy of the of one of his nephews mm-hmm. at the funeral that. Said that he had a certain purposefulness, intentionality, is that he had to lift people up. Mm-hmm. You know, that was, he thought that was a, you know, a particular part of his, that was a particular character of his ministry, of how to lift people up. And he did that for so many people.
Wow. Bishop, the Chrism Mass is right around the corner.
Yeah,
I think just one of the most beautiful masses there is in the Catholic Church.
I thanks for saying that, Bob. And I think that the priests gather not only because it's a beautiful liturgy, but also because it's, you know, it's good to be together.
Yeah.
But I think they come too because it's something. There's an attraction. Mm-hmm. It's an attractive liturgy to come to, and unfortunately, even though, I mean, anyone can go to this liturgy.
Sure.
But not very many people come, and so I want to again invite people to join the presbyterate of me and the presbyterate of Sacramento to come to the cathedral.
Thursday before Holy Week.
Yeah.
At 6 o'clock.
6 o'clock.
So. Yeah. To just see all these priests, virtually every priest in the Diocese of Sacramento, all gathered, it just gives me chills to see what they have given, not to me, not just to me and the church, but also to the whole region.
What
they have done for good. It's just wonderful to see all of them together.
Yeah, and again, it's called the Chrism Mass because that's where the oil of chrism is blessed, as well as the oil of the catechumenate and the oil of the sick, those oils blessed at the Chrism Mass are then the priests, we bless the oils at the Mass, and then my hardworking staff then takes the oils and divides it all up. So by the time the Mass is finished and the priests go downstairs and go home, that the oils are ready to take back to their parishes. So it's a beautiful, it's a beautiful liturgy. they're filled with some, you know, a certain sense of our humanity, but also of creation. And there's this harmonious, you know, praise and thanks to God for, you know, allowing us to be a part of the priesthood of Jesus Christ, and praying that that the oil of priesthood might be an oil of mercy and wisdom and grace for all the church and for the world.
And for me, it's so unifying to think that the oil you're blessing in Sacramento is going to end up at St. Joseph's in Yreka, mm-hmm. and at, you know, St. Dominic's in Benicia, and all over, you know, yeah. In every single parish. It all originated at the cathedral and then went out to 20 counties.
And I'll go even further than that, Bob, and say that the oil, the olive for that oil originated in Yolo County.
Yolo County. I'm very pleased about that. Yes.
Yes, and that there's
I've driven by that orchard. There's
a Catholic farmers who donate the olive oil,
right.
that is used for the Chrism Mass every year.
It's the work of human hands.
Yeah, the work of human hands. It's a beautiful. So it is there's something very integral about the ritual, and giving some of the challenges that we face, Bob, and some of that because of human sin, that liturgy is very renewing, mm-hmm. and I know for the clergy it's an opportunity for us to once again remember whose priesthood this is.
Right.
It is the priesthood of the Lord Jesus, and that He, the High Priest, sacrificed Himself for us, and that we're called to share in that sacrifice.
You know, there aren't very many dioceses in the United States that can say the oil was raised within the diocese.
Yeah.
I think the Diocese of Fargo would have trouble saying that.
You know, one time there was a new diocese. It was the Diocese of Nogales, Nogales, Sonora.
Right,
Nogales,
right on the Mexican border.
Yeah, right on the Mexican border. And my father grew up in Nogales, Arizona. And so, in any case, family from Nogales had reached out to me and saying, gee, this new poor bishop, he's got nothing, and, uh-huh. you know, and he can't do anything to help him out. So I... just as a gesture, I purchased the vessels of oil, mm-hmm. for the new diocese, and then sent olive oil, uh-huh. from Sacramento,
wow.
to Nogales.
Oh, that's wonderful. Yeah, the beautiful cathedral in Nogales, and also across the border in Mexico, a beautiful cathedral.
Yeah. Well, no, Nogales, Arizona is not a diocese.
That's
Tucson.
Tucson, yeah.
Yeah, but Nogales,
Sonora
became a diocese.
Yeah.
Nogales, of course, and the reality is that... Nogales, Arizona has always stayed this very small little border town.
Right.
But Nogales, Sonora is huge.
It's the same with Calexico.
Exactly, yeah. It's just as huge.
It's huge. I've been in that cathedral in Sonora.
Yeah.
And it is beautiful.
Yeah.
Very interesting area. And I know.
Something about southern Arizona and the Sonoran Desert. There's an enchanting beauty about that area.
There is. Yeah. I remember Bishop Kakanis would go down to the border frequently to the wall.
And offer Mass.
And Holy Communion.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Holy Week. Do you sleep at all?
I do. It's a very busy time, and so, but at least in my case, one of the honestly, Bob, that my brother priests I'm busy during Holy Week, but my brother priests are actually, you know, much busier. I mean, it's because just how should I say? Somebody was asking me about do priests look forward to Holy Week or what? Mm-hmm. And I believe that that's generally true. I said, you know, in some sense that if you were going to have to make comparisons, that Holy would be like our Super Bowl.
Yeah, I had the same thought. Yeah.
And that, you know, there's, sure. This is, you know, I mean, the rituals are, the liturgy is so beautiful and the rituals are so meaningful. And I know that both it's a great blessing for the people of God. But it's also I think priests engage the Holy Week ceremonies because it's also just such a renewing grace for us.
Yeah, I you know, you look at Holy Thursday and so much that has flowed from that.
Yeah.
Obviously, you know, the sacraments and then of course Good Friday and Holy Saturday is that Mass is one of the Masses that I've actually cried at, even though no family member of mine was was coming into the church, because it was so beautiful to see these people as a cradle Catholic, and I know you're a cradle Catholic.
Yeah, yeah.
It's different when you see a convert. My mom was a convert, you know, and it's different. They, as an adult, these people have willingly chosen the faith, mm-hmm. you know, and it's really moving.
Well, and actually, you bringing that up, Bob, it was a reminder to everyone that, to me and to everyone, that because of that, it is that one of the special prayers during the Lenten season should be a prayer for the catechumens who are now the elect and are waiting for baptism or to be received into the church. If one is still looking for, you know, an intention for one's prayer and penance during the Lenten season, remembering and praying for the catechumens, for the elect who will be baptized, is a very good intention. I do the rite of election, which was just a few weeks ago,
right.
and we did. Oh my gosh, let me think. I know I did at least four. I think Father Chris, you know, I couldn't do them all, so Father Chris did at least two, or so. There may have been six or seven rites of election in the diocese, and the cathedral ceremonies were always full, and we did one at St. Clair's, and we did another at. At Sacred Heart in Red Bluff,
mm-hmm.
but those are get a taste of. I mean, as you mentioned, the enthusiasm, the wonder. You know, the certain sense of wonder and awe that many of these men and women have as they're coming into the church. You see that there's something very childlike about them. It awakens me, and I would hope, you know, many of us from a dullness, you know, that we can sometimes be drawn into, and forget the thrill of, you know, what it is of, you know, of meeting the Lord.
Yeah. Bishop, our prayers go with you during this time and always.
Well, I hope we pray. Yes, please pray for me and pray for all my brother priests as we celebrate these sacred mysteries, that we may also learn and be renewed by these sacred mysteries and unite ourselves more closely to the one high priest who is priest and victim and who gave himself for us and invites us that as I have done, so you must do.
Thanks so much, Bishop. We'll take a quick break. We'll be back with more on the Bishop's Hour right after this. This portion of the Bishop's Hour is brought to you by a grant from the St. Vincent de Paul Society. Drop by and shop at their thrift store, a beautiful, beautiful thrift store at 2275 Watt Avenue. Open Mondays through Saturdays from 10 to 8 and Sundays from 11 to 6. They also accept donations at the store, donations of furniture, appliances, clothing, books, everyday household items. Your donations help to fund the many projects of the St. Vincent de Paul Society throughout the Diocese of Sacramento. Do such wonderful, wonderful work, and the thrift store is one of the ways they raise the funds to help people throughout the diocese, and also many of their clients are able to access the thrift store for items that they need. You can give them a call. They will come pick it up as well, but you can give them a call. They're at 916-972-1212. And remember, again, the thrift store is open 7 days a week at 2275 Watt Avenue right here in Sacramento. Well, Bishop Soto refers to Christ the King Retreat Center as the jewel of the diocese, and indeed it is. What a beautiful oasis it is. It's located in Citrus Heights, right in the hustle and bustle of the city, and you feel like you're getting away from it all when you turn off the main road and just come into Christ the King Passionist Retreat Center. Christ the King has served Northern California and the Diocese of Sacramento for over 60 years through parish weekend retreats, individual spiritual direction, and a variety of other programs. For information on all the programs that they offer, including residential programs, give them a call. They're at 916-725-4720, or you can visit them at 6520 Van Maren Lane in Citrus Heights. And we certainly thank the St. Vincent de Paul Society and Christ the King Passionist Retreat Center for their fine and longstanding support of the Bishop's Hour. We'd like to thank all the wonderful people and organizations, businesses in town and throughout the Diocese of Sacramento who have provided underwriting for the Bishop's Hour, some in the last few years, some have been with us for a very long time. If you would like to be an underwriter for the Bishop's Radio Hour, it's a wonderful opportunity to support this mission and also to support the diocese and also to get some recognition for your organization or for your business. So the easiest way to do this is to give us a shout, send us an email, radio@scd.org, and we can give you all the details about helping to underwrite the Bishop's Radio Hour. Again, that's radio@scd.org. This portion of the Bishop's Hour is brought to you by a grant from the Mercy Foundation, enriching lives in the Sacramento region through Sisters of Mercy ministries in healthcare, education, housing, and the care for the poor and elderly. For the Mercy Foundation, philanthropy is one of the most powerful expressions of compassion and love. Just as many people in our community need a hand, countless others are reaching out to them with comfort and hope. You can express your care and concern for the less fortunate with a gift to the Mercy Foundation. You can give them a call, 916-851-2700. That's 916-851-2700. And you can be confident that fully 100% of your contribution will support the Sisters of Ministry of Mercy Ministry or ministries that you choose. And what a wonderful treasure Easter's Catholic Books and Gifts has been for all of us here in the diocese as they transition into new ownership and management. They continue to offer wonderful workshops, wonderful resources for the Catholic community throughout the Diocese of Sacramento. Not only does Easter's provide a wide array of Catholic books, both current releases and longtime classics, but they also sponsor a number of valuable workshops and lectures throughout the year. They're located at 6916 Sunrise Boulevard in Citrus Heights. Give them a call, 916-338-7272. We also receive a generous underwriting support by Crumley & Associates, a private wealth advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services. If you have questions about retirement, Crumley and Associates can help you with their confident retirement approach that can help define a clear roadmap to get you where you want to go. You can contact them, get all the details at Crumley and Associates, 7956 California Avenue in Fair Oaks. They're at 916-638-4600. That's 916-638-4600. And we are certainly appreciative of the fine and longstanding support of the Mercy Foundation, of Easter's Catholic Books and Gifts, and of Crumley and Associates.
Hi, this is Katie Parada, Executive Director of Catholic Schools for the Diocese of Sacramento, and you are listening to the Bishop's Hour with Bob Dunning.
Thank you, Katie, for that wonderful introduction, and thanks for all the great work you do for our great Catholic schools here in the Diocese of Sacramento. Well, we are just pleased and honored to welcome in Vivian Dutrow, editor at Ignatius Press. Vivian, good day to you.
Good day to you too, Bob.
Blessings as we approach Holy Week and all of that. And so good to have you on the air with us on the first day of spring.
How about that? We made it.
We made it. And we're all excited here in the Diocese of Sacramento because Bishop Soto granted us a special day of dispensation on St. Patrick's Day a couple of days ago. And so all the Irish Catholics here were able to have corned beef.
Yes. Archbishop Corleone did that in San Francisco also, because St. Patrick is one of the patron saints of the city. So that's a longstanding tradition to be dispensed on a Friday during Lent when the feast day falls on that. Yeah,
I find it interesting. The Irish put St. Patrick's Day right in the middle of Lent. It's always in Lent. There's no way for it not to be in Lent.
I know. That's kind of nice of them, isn't it?
It is very nice of them. So, yeah, that's great. Well, I am just looking at I don't even know where to start here. I feel like a kid in a candy store with all these wonderful books. I'm looking at children's books. Let's start with Confide in Mary, Our Mother in Heaven.
Oh, this is just a lovely little book, and I really mean little. I mean, it's about, 6 inches by 5 inches or something, and beautiful, touching illustrations on every page. And it's really a book to introduce children to devotion to Mary by first giving us her life, told in very simple words, the Annunciation and the Visitation and so on. But also the wedding of Cana and the cross. I mean, it really covers Mary's whole life. And then the Little Marian Way, which I'd never seen that expression before, but to show us just how touching a mother Mary is and how we can approach her as a child. That's really kind of the essence and charm of this book, which is why it's a great book for children. And then it includes some prayers and some saints who were particularly devoted to Our Lady to give you kind of added inspiration. I just love it. I just think it's one of the sweetest books I've ever seen to introduce Mary to young children.
Yeah, and you're talking maybe up to what, about age 7 to maybe 12, something like that?
Yes, I would say so, but I would not wait till they're 7 to introduce this book.
Yeah, I think it says 7 on the back, and I'm thinking, I think younger than that, maybe 4 or 5.
I think 4, beginning at 4, but of course they won't be able to read it at the age of 4, so you, the parent, will need to read it to your child, but that's wonderful too, because
sometimes that's even better.
I agree. So, yes, I would start this book as early as 4, but a 7-year-old can probably read it. And so, it's really, really a sweet book.
Yeah, and as always, the illustrations are very touching.
Yes. This is another one of these jointly published books with Magnificat. It had originated in France, and they just do such a beautiful job on the illustrations and production values of all these books have just been wonderful.
And let's talk now about the In the Shadows of Rome, The Missing Maiden.
Oh, that is the last in this Shadows of Rome series. This is, they're kind of like Hardy Boys in ancient Rome. This is during the persecution under Emperor Diocletian, mm-hmm. and there are these underground Christians, and these boys who are not Christians get caught up in these mystery-type stories, like Hardy Boys sleuthing, you know, and this is the last in the series, The Missing Maiden, and it's about a vessel virgin who goes missing, and you really learn a lot about the whole cult of Vesta in ancient Rome, the fact that the Romans believed that these this fire had to keep going or the Rome would collapse. And these young girls who are chosen to keep the fire burning in the temple to Vesta. And just learning all of that is so fascinating. And then how these kids get involved in trying to figure out what happened to her. And, it's an exciting story. And so it closes out this series that we've been publishing, the Shadows of Rome series.
So this is book number 6.
Yes, and they don't need to be read in order because each time the characters are sort of reintroduced, you know, kind of like Hardy Boys or Nancy Drew, mm-hmm. you know, you don't have to read them in any particular order, but the stories do build on each other, so it's nice to begin at the beginning if you can, but I can recommend the whole series. It's really great. I would say for about, you know, 9, 10 years old and up, mm-hmm. Once they can start reading chapter books on their own, yeah.
It's written by Sophie D. Mullenheim, winner of the Regina Medal. I look at that word Regina as my grandmother's name.
Oh.
And she insisted, because she was from Germany, that it was Regina.
Oh, how about that? That's
yeah.
A hard
and
sound
so every time
German.
I see that and I see the name pronounced Regina, which is much more common, I think of my grandma and how she would always correct us.
Right,
although we
right.
didn't call her that, we called her grandma. But you know, we knew what her name was, and of course, there's a beautiful city in Saskatchewan named after her.
How about that?
Yeah. All right. Let's see. This next one. This is for modern times. I'll tell you how to handle my emotions, and this is sadness.
Yeah, so this also is a series. This is the fourth and last book in this series on the emotions, each book on a different emotion. And I just love these books for helping children learn what is an emotion and what do you do about it. You don't necessarily choose the emotions you feel, right? You get angry, you get sad, you get happy, you know, you can be happy or... you know, what do we do when we feel these things? You know, we might not be in control of how we feel, but we are definitely in control over what we do about it. And that's what these books teach children to do, to sort of learn that self-mastery over their emotional life, which is why these books have to be for at least 7 years old and up, because you have to be at that age of reason, right, where you can kind of talk through...
Right.
So you're sad. Why are you sad? I mean, all the children in this book are sad for perfectly good reasons, right? A friend moves away, a dear uncle dies, and a girl, the last story, there's three stories. The last story, a child has kind of a blues because her mother is out of town temporarily, and it's kind of discombobulating when mom is away, and things aren't going as smoothly, and she's not there to give you a hug and that kind of thing.
Right.
And so each of these situations are completely relatable and completely understandable why a child would feel sad. But what can the child do about it? That's the million-dollar question, and that's what this book tells you.
This one chapter, Charlotte has a blues. Charlotte groans as she looks out her bedroom window. More fog. I think we could say that. More atmospheric rivers.
Yes. That's right. Well, here in San Francisco, we also get a lot of fog.
You get a lot of fog. Yes, you.
Yeah.
Yes. And actually, here in Sacramento, we get what you know we call tule fog, which it doesn't roll in as it does in the bay, but it comes right out of the ground. You know, you could be driving along on a clear starlit night, and all of a sudden you hit a bank of fog, and it's whoa.
Right. Yeah. right. Yeah, I lived in the Central Valley for a few years.
Uh-huh.
And yes, that Thule fog. I mean, literally, it can be so thick you can't see the house across the street.
You can't. Yeah, you can't see your hand in front of your face.
Yeah. So that's right. So she's depressed because her mother's away and the weather's crummy and everything seems to be going wrong and this just starts to pile up, you know. But an art teacher gives her the glass is half empty or half full lesson, you know. And can you count your blessings and can you find things to be grateful for? And that's what pulls the child out of her sadness. Well, my goodness, when I work on these books, I'm learning things as an adult. I was being reminded, perhaps, of things I already was taught. But, you know, your emotions can really get the better of you if you let them. And to be reminded of there are things you can do to respond to your emotions that can really help.
Because we all have emotions, and we have them for a reason, but they can become part of your personality almost if you don't recognize what's going on. You know, like
right.
You're always sad, or you're always grumpy, or everything's always wrong.
Right. That's right. And so you have to have a little, critical thinking therapy, you know, where you stand back and try to look objectively at, well, why am I sad? And is there anything I can do about it? And am I actually encouraging this sadness by ruminating and brooding and going round and round? And, you know, how can I pull myself out of myself, you know?
Yeah, almost to where you get to where you evaluate situations as to what's wrong with them. And how's it going to be negative to me instead of like, you know, it's a bright new day.
And this pulling out of yourself. So the very first story, when this girl, her friend moves away and she's brooding over this and thinking, you know, all these negative thoughts. And it's her mother who encourages, you know, there's a lonely old lady down the street who needs help picking her fruit in her garden. Why don't you go see if she can use your help? And so the child learns that really important lesson that sometimes it's reaching out to the needs of others that pulls us out of ourselves. And now we're not so sad anymore, interestingly enough, because my eyes are no longer on myself, they're on somebody else.
Our next book here, and we're talking with Vivian Doudreau from Ignatius Press, an editor at Ignatius Press, The Lives of Saints, and I love the illustrations in this book. There's so many people. You could look at one picture and see, oh, I just saw somebody new that I haven't seen. You could say, I have a granddaughter who's very fond of, she's 9 now, but she's not too old for this, but when she was 5, 6, 7, and she'd see these characters in the book, and she'd spend hours going, oh, there's another person I didn't see before. Oh, there's somebody in the water trying to get the boat out of the water. You know, it's like it's just really fascinating to see all the different people. And then all wrapped around, I'm looking right now at St. Hildegard of Bingen in Germany.
Yes. So this is sort of a Where's Waldo for Catholic children. We put the one out on Jesus, the Seek and Find Jesus. And now this one is the Seek and Find, of different saints. And so on each set of pages, you've got this whole sort of Where's Waldo world in front of you with lots of people doing lots of things. And the child is supposed to be looking for 2 children and pet cats and a teacher and his daughter. They're somewhere in the picture. And in the meanwhile, while you're looking for them, oh, my goodness, all the things that you start to see and the life of that saint starts to kind of unfold before your eyes. So you mentioned St. Hildegard, who was a Benedictine nun. So now what you're in, actually, is the Benedictine, the abbey. You're in the abbey where she lived, and you're seeing all the things these nuns do, you know, the gardening of their own food and caring for the sick and taking care of the poor and praying and praising God and all these things that these nuns are doing that you start to notice while you're looking for these children and their teacher.
Yeah,
and the cats. It's really fun looking for the cat.
Oh, it really is. It's fascinating. It really gets them into the story. And I mean, the saints in this are just so, you know, St. Damien of Molokai. What an inspirational story that is, you know. And, of course, St. Francis, I've seen the surveys. I think he may be the most popular saint.
Francis of Assisi?
Yeah.
Yes, and Francis Xavier is in here too.
Yes.
So isn't that a bit of excitement? You know, the ship and he looks like he's in India. And by the way, you mentioned Saint Damien of Molokai. You're thinking to yourself, oh, how on earth is an artist going to portray a leper colony?
Yes.
with in an attractive way for children, but the artist manages to do it, You see Father Damien tending to the sick and the sick tending to each other. And, it's beautiful.
Well, and, you know, I mean, something that you'll notice different in that is so many of the people without shirts, and some kids can say, how come? And then you can explain about leprosy.
You can explain that they're in Hawaii.
Mm-hmm. And they're in Hawaii. Yeah,
but they're not on vacation.
Exactly. Yeah, it's odd because you know, when you think of Hawaii, you don't think of an island like Molokai.
Right, that's right. You think of all the resorts and everything, everybody having a good time. And here, Father Molokai, as you know, he volunteered to go to that leper colony.
Yes, indeed, he did.
He was working as a missionary in the Hawaiian Islands, and the bishop asked for a volunteer to go tend to the sick on Molokai, and whoever it was who had volunteered knew he would never return.
He would never return, that's right.
It was really a death sentence, that anyone who goes there would likely succumb to leprosy and die there. And so Father Damien to do this, I mean, this is why we honor him as a saint, because only a saint would do such a thing.
You know, then Saint Vincent de Paul, a great way to explain to kids about the Saint Vincent de Paul Society, which wasn't actually founded by Saint Vincent de Paul, but was named after him.
Named after him by someone who, you know, in following his spirit of care of the poor.
Right.
Osmond, right, was the guy's name who founded the Saint Vincent de Paul Society.
Right.
But also you see the nuns, which were the Daughters of Charity. He founded that order of women. So Louise de Marillac, also a saint. So you see Saint Vincent de Paul at work among the poor here in this picture of Paris. And then you see those nuns doing all the heavy lifting. It's beautiful. It's beautiful to see that collaboration between the priest and the nuns and all caring for others.
And I'm still not ready to see the name Saint Teresa when I see the drawing of Mother Teresa. You know, is she's still mother to a lot of us?
Yes, she's still a mother. She will always be a mother.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of like Saint Padre Pio. You know, really the name the title of father is not in his name as a saint.
Right.
Like Saint Pio of whatever. But we all called him, we all call him still Padre Pio, right, Father
Yeah,
Pio.
Still Padre
it's
Pio.
It's the same kind of thing, Mother Teresa. She will always be a mother. And this, too, is beautiful. Like, how do you make all of this dire poverty something attractive to children? Well, this artist does it because there are those missionaries of charity doing all those good works. It's really a wonderful book. And as I say, we also have the Seek and Find of the Life of Jesus, also in print. Mm-hmm. And there's one of the apostles as well, and I don't recall now if we've already done that one or that's still in the works. We have the Life of Jesus, Seek and Find, and now this one, The Lives of the Saints. And I think there's also one on the apostles. So
Oh, very
That's a great
good.
Series.
And the final one, and which is appropriate because we only have about 2 minutes. Time flies when you're on, Vivian. Tommy DiPaola. Tommy, I guess it is. Yeah, Christopher, the holy giant.
I just love Tommy DiPaola. We've talked about him before, you know, that we're able to reprint some of his marvelous books. But this one on St. Christopher, who's sort of fallen he's fallen off the Roman calendar. Mm-hmm. And there's an author's note in the back of the book with Tommy DiPaola explaining why he was so attracted to St. Christopher and wanted to keep his legend alive, even though he's off the Roman calendar.
Right.
He thinks his legend is still a beautiful story, and it is. And he brings it to life with his wonderful, marvelous illustrations.
Well, I remember St. Christopher being one of the major stories in my childhood.
Yes, and Tommy DiPaola says the same thing, that he grew up with St. Christopher medals. Everybody had one.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. And so, you know, he thinks this story is worth retelling, and I agree with him. I think it's a marvelous story of the giant searching to serve someone greater than himself. And then the irony of his carrying the child.
Yep.
Right? But Jesus coming to us in these ways of smallness and weakness, you know, coming to us as a child. Or we just had recently at Mass, you know, the Samaritan woman at the well. There's Jesus coming to that woman as a tired, thirsty traveler.
Mm-hmm.
You know, God being veiled in this way and then allowing us to draw close to him. And it's just beautiful, the giant carrying the Christ child across the river and then the child revealing, I'm Jesus, you know? I'm the one you've been looking for. It's just a beautiful story.
Yeah, it's just a great story. We didn't really get a chance to get too much into the Garden of Wonders, but it also is just brilliantly illustrated. And
it's brilliantly told. This is Saint Hildegard von Bingen being brought to life through a child who was sick. And, you know, Hildegard von Bingen was a healer, in addition to being a mystic and a saint and everything else. That, too, is a wonderful book, The Garden of Wonders, especially if you know a sick child, by the way.
Vivian, always a joy to talk with you. We'll have to get you on again soon. I greatly appreciate all you do and you spending some time with us.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed very much talking about books, as you know.
Yes, so, indeed. I do, too.
I appreciate your passion.
Well, God bless you and all your family at this time and everybody there at Ignatius Press.
Thank you. And to you and yours, too, Bob.
Thanks so much, Vivian.
Okay.
Take care. That's Vivian Doudreau, who's
bye-bye.
The editor at Ignatius Press. That's going to do it for us for today. Thanks for listening. God bless everyone. We'll talk with you again soon.
To the cross I look, and to the cross I cling. Of its suffering I do. Of its work I do sing. On it my Savior, both bruised and crushed, showing that God is love and God is just. Death. You call me in. with a lie, and I was under your wrath. Now through the cross I'm reconciled.